Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, I'm coming home. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm hoping you hear these words. Your gray stern blue, gray stern blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care and I won't let go. Even though we're oceans away, you're
another wonderful episode of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. And once again, as we do every single week, we bring you news and commentary that's hard-hitting, full of critical analysis, full of news that the corporate mainstream media, I can't even call it news, but the corporate back mainstream media will never touch in 1,000 years unless the whole media system throughout the U.S. is destroyed and built from the ground up. And so we've got so much to cover in the next hour and 25 minutes. I want to hit the ground running as we usually do. Once again, by popular demand, this gentleman, a friend, comrade of mine, one of the finest investigative journalists. He's a freelance journalist, does not work for any mainstream media outlet. in any shape, form, or fashion. He's done tremendous work throughout the continent of Africa, as well as other parts of the world, unearthing and exposing those who the mainstream media are in bed with, and that is why they won't expose them. He also exposes disingenuous nonprofit organizations that are propped up by the mainstream media, that are propped up by Western governments, for the simple fact that these nonprofit organizations, these so-called NGOs, these so-called activists, have no problem watching countless scores of Black Africans die, at the hands of their corporate partners and clients and so forth. And so, he's none other than Keith Harmon Snow. We had him on the show about a month ago, and so many of you requested him back because there was so much that we weren't able to get into. And once again, so we're gonna pick up where we left off. And in this episode, we're gonna get into everything from the Enough Project to the Raise Hope for Congo Project and what frauds they are. We're gonna get back into John Pendergrass, and we're gonna talk about everything from AFRICOM's covert war in Sudan, but also something that is kind of a big story that's not a big story, if that makes sense, is the recent death of Omar Bongo in Gabon. It should be a much bigger story than it is, but most United States media outlets, mainstream media outlets, didn't even pick up the story, period. But then even when you look outside, we look at the Western media, whether it was France or BBC or what have you, they painted Omar Bongo in a very different view, a very different perspective than so many on the ground in Gabon saw him as. And so Keith has done a tremendous amount of research around that. He's going to get into that and the connection of Omar Bongo and his regime with France, and also getting to some other connections that are going to probably be very, very surprising to you. So Keith, he's on the line right now. Keith, welcome back to Your World News. It's our pleasure to have you on again.
Hi, Solomon. That was an amazingly gracious introduction. Thanks so much.
Not a problem. I want to actually get started off the bat. I want to kind of just hit the ground running, a continuation of what we were kind of talking about before the end of the last show that we did. And we were talking about the Save Darfur nonprofit organization. And I'd like to pick up with some of the work that you've done around the Enough Project, and also this new nonprofit organization that comes out of the Enough Project and under the tutelage, if you will, of John Pendergrass, and that's the Raise Hope for Congo. What information do you have on that you think that people need to know about this individual and these two organizations, or three organizations, I guess?
Sure. There's actually more than three. I call them clones of the International Crisis Group, but you could also call them clones of the Enough Project, and that would be the One Project, O-N-E, One, meaning one person can make a difference, you, me. We can all make a difference if, as one person, we'd signed up to this program and do what they think we should do, which is to give us some idea that, you know, we can make a difference by just sending $20 or dialing 1-800-STOP-GENOCIDE, which is another one of the Enough Projects or the International Crisis Group's creations. Dial 1-800-STOP-GENOCIDE, and your phone call, the charges from your phone call, will go into the organization and supposedly will register you to help stop genocide in Sudan. This is, you know, absolute nonsense. It's a scam. It should be, people should be arrested, and they should be charged with a conspiracy to extort or extortion or whatever. I mean, they're total scandals. The Enough Project, Raise Hope for Congo. You got to look at where the money comes from, as usual. Follow the money. Behind Raise Hope for Congo, behind Enough, behind the One Project, behind the International Crisis Group are FLAC organizations, intelligence organizations, and think tanks like the Center for American Progress. Now, they're pumping a lot of money into these programs. If you look at a so-called grassroots initiative produced by Raise Hope for Congo, you look at all their brochures and their flyers and their postcards, they're fancy, expensive stuff. Grassroots does not have that kind of money. Grassroots means going to the root of the problem. Radical means going to the root of the problem. The Enough Project is the problem. It's the very problem. And it's what it's doing is co-opting the power behind any true grassroots movement and make it impossible for someone who is grassroots, or some organization who's grassroots, or some Congolese or Namibian spokesperson who is grassroots to be ever heard in a system where the people that make it look like they're grassroots are getting all the attention, getting published in the newspapers. And so that's what the International Crisis Groups does. That's what their role is. It's to co-opt and cover up and make invisible the real movement for freedom and truth in Africa, in this case. And we could, you know, find other examples. The International Crisis Groups operates with a big focus on Africa, but they also have other programs in other areas, if I remember correctly. But their big thrusts are Darfur or Sudan, Congo, and they have a little bit on Uganda, but it's always targeting the so-called Lord's Resistance Army, which is supposedly this, you know, nasty, crazy, militant, religious, fanatical organization that goes around kidnapping children. And it doesn't ever talk about the real problem in Uganda, the real problem in Central Africa, and that would be Yoweri Museveni and the dictatorship currently in power in Uganda, who's been in power since 1985, who are responsible for the genocide in Rwanda, who are responsible for killing, brutalizing, massacring in the Congo, and ripping off the Congo, and responsible today for involvement in the war in Sudan, and have been involved. Uganda's been involved in the war in Sudan since it began, virtually, since 1990 at least, when the U.S. started funding the war in Sudan, funding the Sudan People's Liberation Army through President Museveni in Uganda. And instead of targeting Museveni as the problem, of course, he gets all the IMF loans and all the structural adjustment programs that he institutes, which are bad for Uganda and bad for the people. He gets all this corporate support, and he gets to be billed as this democratic leader, you know, even though it's a one-party dictatorship since 1985. And he gets to be billed as a hopeful new brand of African leader, which there's no truth behind that whatsoever, especially if you look at the fact that up in northern Uganda, there's some 2.1 million Acholi and other indigenous people forced onto these death camps since at least mid-1990s, especially 1997, forced onto these death camps that are, if there's a classic example of genocide in the world, this is it, and it's being committed by the government of Yoweri Museveni. But the Enough Project, the International Crisis Group, other American organizations that are functioning like public relations agencies for the Ugandan dictatorship, they make it look like the problem is this guy Joseph Kony. And then you got to ask, who is this guy Joseph Kony anyway, and where does he get his funding, and where does he get his logistical equipment, his military equipment, his satellite telephones, and why can't the most powerful countries in the world, like the United States, track down some little guy like that and eliminate him, if that's what they really want to do, which is what they claim they want to do. But it really revolves around power in Washington and Joseph Kony's connections to Washington, or connections to China, or connections to Sudan, or connections to Israel, or connections to the Republicans versus the Democrats, because Museveni has always been very deeply, more deeply in the Democratic camp in the United States than in the Republican camp. And that's why, same thing in Congo, that's why you've got this war. That's why Mobutu, who was supported by the Republican camp at a deeper level, was taken out in 1997 by Bill Clinton. So there's these other issues that are never brought to the front by, for example, the Resolve Project is another one of them, created by the International Crisis Group and John Prendergast, and the Enough Project. And they, Enough in this case is supposed to mean we've had enough of the dictatorship stuff, you know? Or the enough genocide. We have to stop genocide. So it's all just a front for power, and it's serving corporate interests, and it will serve powerful corporate interests, and it will always make the African people or keep the African people poor, and the rest of us, if we participate, stupid.
Right.
Completely co-opting us.
Right. That's a slant that you don't hear too much when you look into. The New York Times or Washington Post, when they talk about the Enough Project. I mean, this guy, Prendergast, has been propped up. He's testified in front of Senate and Congress.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's just amazing, you know.
Who is John Prendergast? You know, if I can interrupt, that's a very good question.
Oh, please do.
1997, John Prendergast was on a panel with another guy named Roger Winter. John Prendergast and Roger Winter both said openly, as at the time, Winter was the head of the U.S. Committee for Refugees, and that's not a refugee organization. It's another front group. It's another power group. It's about manipulation, intelligence gathering, and cover for other interests. And John Prendergast at the time was National Security Council under William Jefferson Clinton. Another guy that was an insider with these two guys was Walter Kansteiner, who was also National Security Council under William Jefferson Clinton, and then later was connected to the intelligence establishment under George Walker Bush. And Kansteiner, Prendergast, and Roger Winter, for example, they all basically were saying the same thing at the time, and that is we need to balkanize the Congo, which means divide it up, conquer it, divide it up so that it can, you know, function as a proper state in the world, when meanwhile, you know, corporate interests are making the place a disaster area. They're creating the disaster. They're creating the conflict. They're creating the refugee situation. And the other line of argument at the time in 1997 was, of course, Sudan. And if you recall, if people remember, in 1997, President Clinton launched missile attacks, which were completely illegal, against the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical factory in Khartoum, claiming that it was a weapons production facility or something like that, which was nonsense. It was the number one and the only production facility for medicine in Sudan. And by putting that out of action, of course, a lot of people were unable to get medical supplies, drugs in particular, which serves, bingo, big pharmaceutical corporations from the United States, because somebody's got to provide that stuff, and it becomes the so-called humanitarian sector, which has to provide relief to people who are starving and dying of disease, and it does it through the support and with the support of big pharmaceutical corporations. So go back to 1997. John Prendergast was National Security Council, and he was on this panel with Roger Winter. Who was Roger Winter? Roger Winter in 1989 and 1988 was in Washington, D.C., and he was organizing the overthrow of the government of Rwanda, President Juvenal Habyarimana. And in 1990, Roger Winter supported the Rwandan Patriotic Front invasion from Uganda of Rwanda, and it was an illegal act, which we talked about last time, the invasion of a sovereign nation by a guerrilla force, but it was never portrayed in that way by the media, because the media was supporting the Rwandan Patriotic Front and the overthrow of Rwanda. Rwanda was controlled by France, and it had been controlled by France since 1973 under Habyarimana. Now, that's an interesting point when we get into the subject of Francophone Africa and Gabon, or Cameroon, or Burkina Faso, or Togo, or Benin, or Central African Republic, or Congo-Brazzaville, all these countries that had such incredibly powerful French influence for so many years under the colonial and so-called post-colonial establishment. But get back to Prendergast and Roger Winter. Roger Winter was there in 1994 when the United States clients, meaning Yoweri Museveni and the Ugandan military and the Rwandan Patriotic Army, marched into Rwanda, overthrew the government of Rwanda. It was basically a coup d'etat by double presidential assassination in 1994. Called it genocide, and basically won the war for the United States and Israel and Belgium and Britain and these other powerful factions connected to the Rwandan Patriotic Front. So Roger Winter's role was to help overthrow the government of Rwanda, and it succeeded in 1994, and he was there on the battlefield at the front lines in 1994. In 1989, he was helping to produce propaganda, which we could easily point to and say, this is genocide propaganda. It's whipping up fear of some people, meaning the Hutu people in Rwanda, in favor of other people, meaning the Tutsi people in the diaspora. And, of course, the propaganda mythology is that the Tutsis are the people without a state, another Jews without a country, people without a homeland. And
right.
All of that mythology supported the propaganda, which made it look like these were the victims, when, in fact, they were actually the killers. So Winter was responsible for the overthrow of Rwanda, and after 1994, after July, when the United States had basically succeeded, this is total support by the Pentagon, funding weapons through Yoweri Museveni in Uganda. When we had succeeded, Roger Winter immediately shifted gear to Sudan, and the goal became to overthrow the government of Sudan. Now, that was President al-Bashir, the current Arab leader of Sudan, the Islamist leader of Sudan, who is an Islamist to begin with, is a problem in this world, so he's obviously going to be targeted for that. But more importantly, the fact that Sudan controls its own resources is something, and operates outside the U.S. European banking system, is something that the system can't tolerate. So in 1997, Prendergast, Roger Winter, and Kansteiner, but mostly Prendergast and Roger Winter, made statements at this panel about how we need to overthrow the government of Sudan by force. It's going to raise a huge problem in the world. It's going to create massive humanitarian refugee crisis. They both said this. And we know that's going to happen, but that's the price we're going to have to pay for getting rid of this nasty dictatorship in Sudan. So this is where John Prendergast comes from. and his connections to Roger Winter. Roger Winter today has a special office in Washington created just for him because of his role as a so-called negotiator in Sudan. Well, Roger Winter is no negotiator. He's an intelligence operative in the South Sudan, which we control at this point. They call him Father, and they also call him General. So Roger Winter's role is very significant, and you don't see that anywhere pointed out in the alternative press or in the mainstream press or anything. It's just totally covered up. Instead, as you pointed out, we've got this guy, John Prendergast, who's supposedly running these supposed peace and peace organizations like Resolve, One, Raise Hope for the Congo, and Enough. And this all comes from the International Crisis Group. So that's the nature of the propaganda system out there. If you see it, if it's all over the place, if it's in the Washington Post or New York Times, if they're mentioning John Prendergast, if he's being given panels at Harvard, you got to believe it's not supporting the interests of the people of Africa, and certainly not African Americans in the United States either.
Right, and you also, part of that propaganda scheme is you have half of Hollywood involved in the One campaign. You have everyone from Clooney to Damon. I mean, you know, they have half Hollywood, you know, part of, you know, one or two or all three of these, or, you know, even more of these nonprofit organizations. And so, you know, unfortunately, you know, a lot of people in America are sheep when it comes to the media and actually current events. And so if so-and-so, you know, big-time actor or actress endorses it, oh, it must be legit, you know, so...
Yeah, I would go back to Amos Wilson and say people have to decolonize their minds. Just look at the movie King Kong. The only dark people you see in the movie are savages. They're rolling their eyes. They're dripping saliva from their mouths. It's all about the undercurrent discourse is about disease and savagery and black people and an absence of civilization and how they're going to overrun the white society in the United States. I mean, just look at all the themes in King Kong. And then you've got, of course, the super goddess. In that case, it was the white girl who King Kong has this, you know, attraction to, and she becomes the superhero. Well, that's the same as Jane Goodall or Diane Fossey or Mia Farrow. I mean, Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey both have organizations involved in the problem, creating problems in the Congo and Rwanda today. And by creating problems, the Jane Goodall Institute is funding some of the militias in the Congo. That's a very serious charge, and it's a very serious reality. But Jane Goodall, you know, she's not the superhero that people think she is. So anyway, decolonize your mind and go back to Hollywood, and you find that, for example, the Star Wars movies, all they did was set the stage for all of the modern unmanned undersea vehicles, unmanned aerospace vehicles, the drones that we're deploying all over the world currently. In Israel, the Israeli drones are being deployed against the Palestinians. They're being deployed also over Sudan. The CIA deploys drones over Sudan and over the sea crossing between Yemen and Somalia. These drones were used over Kinshasa. There was a little Congolese guy who had a pistol or a rifle. He wasn't a soldier. Maybe he was an ex-soldier, but he had a rifle, and he shot down one of these drones over Kinshasa. You know, a million-dollar aerospace drone brought in by Israel and the United States to monitor the Congolese people flying over Kinshasa. The guy shoots it down with a single bullet. Of course, he was made to be the enemy, but I call the guy a hero. So anyway, all of this robotic stuff that was produced is being produced and has been produced and is being deployed as weaponry around the world in ways that we will never see. That stuff, all our thinking or our accepting of that technology all came from the Star Wars series. Luke Skywalker shooting down those little robots that come and invade your space. And today they're using technologies just like those little robots. They'll drop them from a big UAV. A cargo will be dropped onto the ground. It will have all these robots that deploy and head out into the hills. And what they do is they send, it's all sensor systems. And you can imagine, given the state of our technology with cell phones, for example, which is in the public sector, the state of the technology that they have with sensors, you know, and robotics, we can begin to imagine it. And you just go to that film and you get it from that. So Hollywood and Mia Farrow and George Clooney and Ben Affleck, who's a Congo spokesman, and now Matt Damon is all over Haiti and also wants to get involved in Sudan. And it's really important to look at the deep connections between the Pentagon and Hollywood. The Pentagon funds Hollywood directly to produce some of that stuff. General Alexander Haig is on the board of MGM, and he's the guy who, you know, was who said, I'm in charge here after Ronald Reagan was shot. You know, these are not nice people.
Exactly.
You're right. Hollywood's all over it, but we're getting a little bit off the track of murder and slaughter in Africa. But
Still, I think that was like great context that most people have no idea, but now they do have an idea about that. But while we're on the topic of the Pentagon and United States military, if you could talk about AFRICOM's, what you've labeled as AFRICOM's covert war in Sudan, and if you could start off by explaining to the listeners what exactly AFRICOM is, and then put in, you know, and then that could be your point of reference or point of departure into the covert war that they're executing throughout Sudan and some other parts of Africa as well.
Sure. Of course, it's hard to know some of these aspects of the U.S. military, the Pentagon, and how they operate, because it's all a lot of it involves black programs, and a lot of it involves covert operations. Covert operations comes out of SOCOM, Special Operations Command, and they deploy thousands of special operations. There are thousands of special operations going on at this moment all over the world. We don't know what they are. They're targeting individuals. They're assassinating people. They may be just blowing up some little bridge somewhere, or they may be doing something far more subversive, like distributing some or disseminating a psychological operation which disseminates a certain kind of information somewhere to provoke some kind of a response by someone or some kind of a military action or something like that. So SOCOM is a very powerful force, and we don't know much about them. There's no special operations forces who've come forward recently, like John Stockwell in the 1980s, and told us about the CIA operations out of Congo, out of Zaire, out of Angola. There's nobody that I know of from SOCOM who's come forward and told us what SOCOM has been doing, but they wouldn't know anyway. They would only know what they were involved with because it's so highly compartmentalized that it's a need-to-know basis when you have a when you work in classified programs, as I did back in the 80s. You have a need-to-know basis. You only know what you need to know to do your particular little piece of the puzzle. And at the top, of course, the people that know the bigger picture, they aren't necessarily blowing the whistle. So there's SOCOM, and there's Navy SEALs, there's all these special operations forces. 10th Mountain Division is special operations forces. And these guys are doing nasty things in Afghanistan and in Congo and in Sudan, no doubt. And then there's Central Command, which operates out of Stuttgart, Germany. And then there's Pacific Command, and then there's now African Command, the Africa Command. There's, at this moment, no publicly admitted base for AFRICOM. But if I were to wager a guess, I would say that AFRICOM exists on the ground in Africa in two or three places currently. It's got logistical, communications, transportation equipment in place. It's got very sophisticated networks in place, and that would be Uganda, Ethiopia. I said three. Uganda, Ethiopia, the little island of Sao Tome and Principe off the west coast of Africa, and the other one was Ghana. This is just not the picture that people have of Ethiopia and Ghana, for example. But the United States has been funding all kinds of militarization in these countries and shipping in a lot of weaponry through especially Uganda and Ethiopia. Uganda would be, I think, our most powerful ally in Africa in terms of military capacity and training, but Rwanda is right on the heels of Uganda as well. And Ethiopia, of course, the amount of money that was sent to Ethiopia for so-called aid, which has been converted into weaponry, is just unbelievable. And nobody's done a story about it. Nothing at all. And that stuff is going in. Ethiopia, of course, needs to be controlled because we're looking at the little states up in the corner there on the Indian Ocean, Somalia, Kenya, Sudan, Eritrea. You can cross the Red Sea easily to get to Saudi Arabia as well as Yemen. So it's a very powerful place, and there's a lot of oil up there. Mm-hmm. And the Africa Command has been designed because the Pentagon is always ever expanding its operations in the world and its power in the world through all kinds of, you know, systems of co-option and open propaganda and community building and this kind of nonsense that you'll see in the media, which is pictures of U.S. soldiers holding some baby somewhere or smiling with some children at a school they just built near their base of covert operations in Ethiopia, for example. So AFRICOM has been, you know, given a budget. It's been given a command. It's been created. It's, I think it exists on the ground already. Sao Tome and Principe, this nasty little island, or this little island with a nasty little U.S. presence off the coast of West Africa. That's there's been a lot of stuff about Sao Tome and Principe. If you look in the intelligence community in certain newsletters, for example, you can find out about this stuff. Wayne Madsen talks extensively about the U.S. interest in Sao Tome and Principe in his book Genocide and Covert Operations in Africa, 1993 to 1999. And Sao Tome and Principe also is very close to Gabon, which brings up the subject again of the U.S. military interests and connection to Gabon. So that, you know, is kind of a very broad sort of general sweeping overview of what AFRICOM is all about. But basically, it's a lot of money, a lot of U.S. soldiers, a lot of covert operations going on in a lot of countries at this very moment.
Right. You just brought up Gabon. Just recently, within the last couple of weeks, the longest standing, you know, head of state of any country within the continent of Africa, Omar Bongo, just passed away. He was in power for more than four decades. He just passed away, and throughout the Western media, not just the U.S., but, I mean, the U.S. media, actually most U.S. media that I looked at, you know, didn't even touch his death. But, you know, when you look at, you know, Western media, whether it was France or England, you know, he was hailed as this, like, great, great guy. You know, he was, you know, and that, it's weird. I mean, whenever you hear a Western country hail, you know, any country as you know, their head of state as a good guy, you almost have to kind of be very wary and see, you know, look behind the veneer and see, is there something more than that? Is this a person that, you know, what would precipitate them to say somebody's a good guy? Because usually they're labeling folks bad guys because they, you know, they thwart their efforts or try to resist their efforts to plunder and do all sorts of things, you know, imperialist related and neo-colonization and so forth. And this guy was hailed as this great, great guy. And I've never heard that kind of characterization about, usually if there's an African leader that's been in power for more than 20 years, I mean, they're like, you know, he's a dictator, you know, he was in power for such and such long, his rule, iron fist, this, that, and the other. Who was Omar Bongo, and what was his leadership and his 40 years really like on the ground and for the people who are Gabonese?
Well, apartheid. Gabon is an apartheid state. And when I think about writing about Gabon and what people know about it, you know, do you start a story with a sentence like that? Gabon is an apartheid state. Gabon is a state of state terror in Gabon. You know, do you start that way? And I always say to myself, this is the point of departure from which to begin discussing the problem of Gabon, not the point we have to get to in the end. It's not the final sentence, Gabon is an apartheid state. It's the first sentence. And there's a reason it's an apartheid state. Of course, slavery off the coast of Gabon, for your listeners who don't know and don't have a map in front of them, Gabon is a fairly small country by African standards off the west coast of Africa. It's situated between the Republic of Congo, which is the small Congo, Congo Brazzaville, named after the French guy who invaded Brazzaville back in 16 or 17 something, whatever. Brazzaville set up the French networks of exploitation and slavery and mutilation that occurred, just like under King Leopold, we had Henry Morton Stanley doing it for King Leopold in the Big Congo. So Gabon is situated between Republic of Congo to the south and Equatorial Guinea to the north, and I think that's it. And off the coast, Equatorial Guinea, of course, is landlocked, but there's also a piece of Equatorial Guinea that's a couple of big islands out there in the Gulf of Guinea, which is directly south of Cameroon. And then to the left of Cameroon, you've got successively Nigeria, Benin, Togo, Ghana, Ivory Coast. So the French Equatorial Africa got involved in the slave trade back in 15-something. And the slaves came out of Gabon, out of slaving ports back in 15-something and went to France by 1600 or 1650. And 1780 or something like that, France ruled slavery illegal and continued to be involved in the slave trade in Gabon. And then France basically through a series of, you know, moving into the country through the very difficult jungle and river systems that are in Gabon. It's a very dense, difficult country to cross. The French had a very difficult time getting into the continent of Africa because they chose Gabon. Had they chosen, you know, Kenya, like other interests did, they would have found it as easy as Stanley, for example, who, it wasn't easy, but it was much easier. They couldn't do it in Gabon, but the French set up their ports in Gabon. By the 1800s, they had massive ports there. By the 1900s, and by 1880, they were in complete control of Gabon, and so it became a French colony somewhere around then. And some of the first resources, of course, were they set up some rubber plantations as soon as rubber became a viable product to use, which would be about 1900 or 1895, 1900, 1910, around there. But ivory was the most important. And then soon after that, other raw materials were discovered in Gabon. And, of course, wood was coming out of Gabon since the beginning as well for France. And Gabon became France's base of military and covert operations on the continent, especially equatorial Africa. They had, of course, very powerful interests up in Algeria and up in North Africa, but in the center and the south, they controlled from Gabon. And Gabon means they had a set up military base there, they had intelligence networks, and they branched out to the other Francophone countries in the region, which include Togo, run by a nasty dictator for years, General Guinassabe Eyadema, and nobody knows anything about that, and Paul Biya in Cameroon, is running that country today, I think, but in any case, he ran it for 20-something years, and Biya, another nasty dictatorship that nobody knows much about. Equatorial Guinea, one of the bloodiest countries in the world. Small population density compared to other countries, but one of the nastiest series of dictatorships and bloodshed in that country. The accounts that I've read of that, you know, really make my skin crawl. And I've read a lot about the genocide in Rwanda, but what happened in Equatorial Guinea, which is right next to Gabon, it's a very significant point, has been completely unappreciated and unreported, and hardly anybody has stood up and spoken for the people of Equatorial Guinea. So here's little Gabon. By 1950, the French had basically a playground in Gabon. Not only did they have intelligence networks controlling their colony and assassinating people and basically a serious case of apartheid, but they also were branching out to all the other countries in the region, including Mobutu in Zaire, of course, later. And as I say, Biya, Eyadema, and they stuck their fingers in Central African Republic, and they stuck their fingers in Congo Brazzaville, which of course is the little country, the little Congo next to them. So when Bongo came to power in the mid-60s, it had been run previously by the first president after the colonialism so-called died, you know, and that was Mba, I think his name was Leon Mba. And Mba was only in power for a couple years, like 3 or 4 or something like that. He was totally handpicked by the French and by the intelligence networks, and so was Omar Bongo. And by 1965 or 66, Bongo was put in power, and he was kept in power from 1966 or 65 until he died in France, the longest-serving so-called, you know, dictator, not so-called, but the longest-serving dictator in Africa. And he was kept in power through these intelligence networks, massacres, covert operations, in a very extreme case of state terror, where the case about Gabon is so unique because the population density is so small in Gabon. It's a very heavily forested, very dense country, and today the population is no more than 1.1 million people for the entire country, which is a very low population and a very low population density. But 80,000 people in the entire country, 80,000 out of 1.1 million, have any access to running water at all. And a very small elite group of those people have been in control since Bongo came to power back in 1965. And Bongo ran this silent, what I call silent dictatorship, or a very silent kind of terror where people are not talking about it, nobody's publicizing it. It's not Rwanda where you've got this open, huge massacring going on all the time, in the 1990s, for example, that raised the specter of genocide and tribalism. So Gabon was able to portray itself differently because of the nature of the population density. And that's one of the tools that Omar Bongo had used to his advantage and that France used to their advantage. So what's the case in Gabon from 1966 until today? big mining, big timber, uranium that came out of Gabon and Niger, another French client state, has built the entire state, national security state of France. France's entire nuclear weapons program, which is hundreds of reactors around the country of France, and its entire nuclear power program, which is hundreds of reactors around the state of France. I think it's over 100. And the entire nuclear weapons complex of France, which was one of the first nuclear powers, has been built out of the bloodshed of the people of both Niger and Gabon. Niger, the second poorest country in the world, and the mines up in the north, and Gabon, which had a major uranium deposit, which was providing for France, and of course has U.S. and other European and Japanese interests connected to it as well. So, for example, at this one site in Gabon today where this uranium mining center was operated, this uranium mine was operated from the late 60s, originally connected to, I think, to Union Carbide. The mines, there's hundreds of, I think it's hundreds of kilometers of tunnels underground in this huge uranium mine. People on the surface have been dying like flies, and there's actually a small Gabonese NGO which has been pushing this issue and trying to get some attention to this. So as usual, you've got, you know, a client state like France, all these white French people using Gabon as its playground, and of course that includes military operations as well as golf and, you know, sea sports, because Gabon has some of the most beautiful beaches, hunting. A lot of the African dictators and a lot of foreigners from, like, presidents in France and other people in powerful places have gone down to Gabon over the years and gone hunting with Omar Bongo in some of these places which have recently been declared reserves. By before Bongo died, he declared them as reserves. And that, again, had its own agenda behind it. It wasn't about conservation. It was about manipulating the United States against France. And so Bongo has become increasingly a problem for the world because he plays off powerful factions against each other, and that's why he was so successful at staying alive. That and the fact that he was backed by the French Secret Service and the CIA and the covert operations that go on to make that possible. I can take a breath there, let you ask a question, or I can tell you about the massacres in Port Gentil in 1990.
Yeah, I'd definitely like to know about that, but something you just said that really caught my attention was that you mentioned that there's masses of white French people that are in Gabon, basically, you know, having everything from luxury condos to golf courses. I've read in your writings before, swimming pools, while the black people, the citizens of Gabon, are living in absolute poverty and misery. And so to me, it seems like another case of white supremacy at its best. Is that an accurate depiction
Absolutely. Yeah, I was not understating the case when I said Gabon is an apartheid state. What does apartheid mean? It means that the people in Gamba, for example, Seti Kama, this village in the south, this region in the south, controlled by Shell Oil Company. When I say controlled by Shell Oil Company, I mean guards at gates, on roads, checkpoints. I mean pipelines and oil derricks and the plumes that they burn off natural gas that are burning, producing these toxic byproducts that have been fairly well documented in the case of Nigeria with the Ogoni people. And I'm talking about, as I say, armed guards protecting gates on roads and airlines. You can't get into Seti Kama without flying. And who controls the airlines and who allows people to come and go? People being killed because they speak against the oil company there. The whites live in fairly nice housing. They have golf courses and swimming pools. They have four-wheel drive vehicles at their disposal all over the place. They catch these incredibly huge fish through sport fishing in the estuaries that exist where the fish come in from the ocean. And we're talking about fish longer than you and me. Big stuff that people pay a lot of money and come down and go fishing for. They have their own private boats. The people live with, if they have a canoe, they have a dugout canoe, but a lot of people don't have any canoes at all. They don't have any much access to the water at all. A lot of the people that are in Seti Kama came to Seti Kama for one reason or another because of the oil and because of the possibility of trying to get some sort of employment there. So there's basically a small settler population of Africans, Gabonese people, who don't function with the support of the French, don't receive any of the benefits of the French and the oil industry, whether it's Shell, whether it's U.S. For example, Halliburton is there, and Schlumberger, both American oil companies, which people should know. If they don't know Halliburton at this point, they should get off they should shut the radio off and shoot themselves in the head. So Halliburton is there, and Shell Oil, and Elf, and all these other oil companies, but down in SETI Comma, it's controlled by Shell. And Elf, of course, is the French espionage oil company, which, of course, got involved in this Angola Gate scandal back in the late 90s, which we could also go into. There's all kinds of scandals that Bongo's been involved in, all kinds of money laundering and extortion, criminal networks and operations, people being assassinated, and, as I said, these massacres in Port Gentil. So the situation for the average Gabonese person is pretty darn bleak. They don't have access to clean running water. They don't have access to any medication. You know, they can't earn a living because most of the jobs are not available to them. The service sector is predominantly run in Gabon by French or white people. And, of course, at this point, there's plenty of people that are not French who are white who are benefiting from this apartheid state in Gabon and will never say anything about it because that's the nature of their white supremacy in their interests. First, they probably don't see it, which is a crime in and of itself. And second, even if they did, they're not going to confront their own interests because it's much nicer for them to go out in that boat and catch those big fish or hang out on the beach.
Exactly.
So it's a nasty state of affairs for the people in Gabon. As I said, 80,000 people at most, and this is a Gabonese government statistic, have access to electricity or clean water. And that's 80,000 out of 1.1 million. The Gabonese government is always inflating the number of people because the more people they can suggest that they have and convince the IMF that they have, the bigger the loans. And, of course, Gabon has been deeply connected to the International Monetary Fund since the 80s and since the concept of neoliberal economics, since the concepts were implemented. And those basically bleed the people dry in favor of corporations. Another problem for the people of Gabon is that the entire water sector and electricity sector, the water sector has been privatized already. And if people know their history of Bolivia, for example, the people stood up against Bechtel a few years ago when Bechtel tried to privatize the water supply. But in Gabon, the people don't stand up against the government of Gabon because most people who do that in any form or other words will be assassinated and have been assassinated. Now, you don't find any human rights organizations saying this. And what is the problem here? Well, the problem is partly white supremacy. It's partly capitalism. You look at the human rights, who the human rights organizations get their funding from. It sometimes involves oil companies and mining companies and other state institutions like USAID, for example, which is another intelligence conduit and a soft wing of the Pentagon. And also the human rights organizations, they have limited budgets and they can only focus on the big crises. So they wouldn't be going after Gabon because it's not a big crisis state. It's a small population density where people are eliminated under this form of silent terror where you can actually ask most French people and they would say, well, Gabon's not like that. Or American people who've heard about Gabon would say, well, it's not a client state of the United States. It's not a terror state. But they're the third largest producer of oil for the United States, never mind France. It's France's entire security policy revolved around the uranium and the oil from Elf. Elf's role was to make sure that the oil flowed to France, always, not interrupted, anything, by any means necessary. What does that mean? It means taking people who complain up in a helicopter that belongs to the oil company, torturing them first, and then throwing them out to the fucking ocean.
Really?
I mean, that's a war crime. That's a crime against humanity. Omar Bongo was not a nice guy. And people know this. They know that this has happened. Who are we talking about? We're talking about General Colin Powell, who flew into Gabon in 2002 because Omar Bongo decided to designate these 10 or 13 national parks. So he became a conservation hero, and the National Geographic ran these stories about him, saving Africa's Eden, and how Bongo was this great guy. And not only that, but he flies all over the continent negotiating peace settlements in places like Sudan and Congo and Zimbabwe. Well, Bongo broke the sanctions for the Ian Smith regime. Bongo was the number one sanctions buster for Ian Smith after South Africa. Ian Smith, of course, is the white supremacist leader of Rhodesia, who the system actually turned on him because they couldn't allow or accept the white face of power in Africa any longer back in the 1960s. So Smith fought back with his supporters, who, of course, were equally capitalist and equally white supremacist. And one of the governments that supported Ian Smith was Omar Bongo. And Bongo had deep connections to South Africa as well. And the biggest crime that Bongo has committed, and not only did he send weapons and logistical support into the war in the Congo, he supported Laurent Kabila at one point around 1998 with logistical support after the Rwandans and Ugandans were thrown out and Bechtel was thrown out by Laurent Kabila and before Kabila was assassinated. he supported Kabila, and then later he supported Bemba, which, of course, Jean-Pierre Bemba is now in The Hague at the work at the International Criminal Court. So Bongo supported the war in Big Congo, and he also supported the war in Congo-Brazzaville, and, of course, the Congo-Brazzaville president, Denis Sassou Nguesso, with his father-in-law. And he's always supported the nasty state of affairs in Congo-Brazzaville. Congo-Brazzaville is one of the nastiest little dictatorships I've ever visited. And you couldn't put your finger on it. There was no killing going on that you could see, but it was more frightening to me than being in Rwanda, Uganda, or the Congo, the Big Congo. But the biggest crime that Omar Bongo committed was supporting the bloodshed in Equatorial Guinea. Because the people, if there are people in the world who are the most downtrodden, forgotten, destitute people in all the system, at the bottom, the very bottom of the totem pole, it would be the people of Equatorial Guinea, because you've got pygmies who are also castigated by their own people, and you've got the regular, I don't want to say, they're not Batwa, but I can't think of the name I want, the Bantu people in Equatorial Guinea, who are at the bottom, very bottom of the telephone pole in this unjust system that we live in. And Bongo supported the bloodshed in Equatorial Guinea for years. He's actually sent troops into Equatorial Guinea in search of oil with the oil companies. So it's a very nasty state of affairs.
And you alluded to, it was interesting, is during this whole thing, I believe he's visited the White House a couple different times, not necessarily this administration right now, but he's been to Washington. He's been a guest of the White House. And during that time, you know, without a doubt, you know, the White House and the U.S. government knew of the atrocities that he was committing on the people, committing to his own people. And one of those was the massacre that occurred with students, mainly students, in the streets of Port Gentile. Can you talk about that massacre that occurred in the streets of Port Gentile?
Sure, of course. 1989. The world was perestroika was ushered in. The Berlin Wall fell, and there was a general global climate of opening, and people in different countries were suddenly feeling that they could stand up and speak against the absence of democracy in their country. So what we saw in China, of course, we all know about, Tiananmen Square. It was advertised because China was considered an enemy state. What we didn't see were the massacres that occurred, the similar situations where people rose up in other countries that were considered client states. So in Zaire, there was a massacre at the University of Lubumbashi. In Cameroon, in Nigeria, at the University of Jos, J-O-S. In Burma, there was, of course, a big crackdown by the forces in power at the time. And in Togo and in Gabon. And in Gabon, we had in 1990, in the spring of 1990, Bongo was being pushed to democratize the country by the United States and France. They wanted to make it look like it was a democratic government, even if the elections were rigged, which they were in the end. There had been no elections before that. But even if the elections were going to be rigged, which is fine to the United States, as long as their man wins, that would be better than having, you know, the face of power that Bongo had been putting on the country since 1965. So in 1990, in the spring, the country was suffering extreme poverty and unemployment and misery for the average Gabonese person because the IMF had instituted its structural adjustment programs in the 1980s. And then there were some, I think it was the price of manganese fell. Manganese is a very significant element in superalloys, in nuclear weapons, and all kinds of aerospace and defense products, in submarines, and all this other stuff, superalloys that require cobalt in Congo also require manganese. Manganese is used for steel. U.S. steel was all over Gabon in the early years, in the 1960s, but they later pulled out, and I haven't figured out quite why. But the price of manganese, I think, also fell at the time. And then people started protesting. They were tired of the 25 or 30 years of dictatorship that they lived with under Omar Bongo and all the lies and all the deceptions and seeing people brutalized and tortured and disappeared. And, you know, we haven't even talked about ritual killings, which are a very big deal in Gabon. And they're kind of a, it's not an African thing. It's a state power thing in Gabon. And so the people protested in early 1990. And Bongo at first was like, I'm not going to put up with this nonsense. And he started cracking down. And then the U.S. and France and maybe some other countries encouraged him, we could say, to be more open. And so he actually opened up the space a little bit and started talking about actual reforms and started making some cosmetic changes that looked like reforms. So the people got a little bit more bolder all the time. But they were still living under these incredibly austere conditions imposed by the World Bank and the IMF. So they couldn't feed their families. And the students were being, the education system was collapsing, and people were unemployed more and more, and the cost of living was higher and higher, and then there was no bread. All of these things combined, as they did in Zaire and other countries, to get the people to really stand up and fight for their rights. And also you had the control, as I pointed out, the white people controlled, the French people controlled most everything in Gabon of any significance and any substance. And what that means is that, for example, the education sector, the books that were brought in for the Gabonese people were different books that were brought in for the Gabonese children in the education sector were different books than were brought in for the French children who were studying, you know, in high schools and grammar schools in Gabon. And the people could see the differences. And at the same time, they were not getting access to the jobs or the education. And so by May of 1990, with all these other pieces that I haven't even talked about, like the nature of the labor force in Gabon with respect to the oil, and you've got to see the oil map of Gabon. The oil is all over the coast of Gabon, offshore, onshore. You know, two-thirds of the country, it looks like, is covered up in oil concessions. So by 1990, all these people involved in the oil sector and all these other grievances that they had, they started to protest. Something happened one of Bongo's opposition members died suddenly in a hotel room, and it was very suspicious in May of 1990. I think it was May 21st or 22nd, 23rd. And so on May 23rd, people really took to the streets. Bongo said, I'm not going to stand for this. I'm going to crush this absolutely. He made that public statement, and then he did. France had already some 600 to 1,000 special French forces. We're talking about the French Foreign Legion, some of the elite of the elite French military, elite of the military in the world, were already stationed in Gabon and remain stationed in Gabon today. And France sent in an additional 500 of these elite paratroopers. And they sent in tanks. And the tanks crushed the barricades in the streets. And they started killing people. And the official statistics of the number of dead in Gabon at the time that you see anywhere, if you do any searching today, you'll find 5 or 6 people dead. That's what the government said. You go talk to people in Gabon who are willing to talk to you, and that's an interesting problem because people know. You know, one French woman said to me, you just don't ask these questions here. And she walked away, you know. But the killings in Port Gentil is ELF space of operation. ELF means the intelligence networks of France. Jacques Foucart, Mr. Africa for France, who was involved with all these assassinations and coups. He's the Maurice Templespan of France. And Maurice Templespan, of course, is our man from Harvard University and from the Diamond Networks and from the yachts off the coast of Martha's Vineyard with Bill Clinton and Jackie Kennedy's lover and all this stuff. And
right.
Jacques Foucart was the guy that they sent, that France had, who controlled all these French dictatorships that I've mentioned already. And intelligence operatives were put directly in control of the corporation ELF Aquitaine, which is, of course, French's number one oil company, had all the power in Gabon. It was a state within a state, so that within the ELF Aquitaine networks, when the protests began, first offshore, they were able to maintain the offshore pumping because the system was entirely self-contained. They got their own. They had their own airlines. They had their own food shipped in. They had their own shipping. They had their own defense sector. They had their own paramilitary. They protected the oil companies. The oil kept flowing. That was the role of ELF Aquitaine, to make sure that France had oil no matter what happened in the world. And so when the people protested, Bongo cracked down on them. They sent in the paratroopers. And for 3 or 4 or 5, from May 23rd until May 30th, they went around with the Presidential Guard, and the Presidential Guard is these elite group that whose role it was to keep the president, keep Bongo in power. They went around killing, dumping bodies in mass graves. Now, this is Omar Bongo. This is not a peacekeeping president. This is not a negotiator. This is not a Democrat. This is not anybody that Barack Obama should feel saddened about, because he said, after Bongo's death, he said he was saddened to hear that Bongo, who had been so pivotal in maintaining U.S.-Gabonese relations for 41 years, and was and this is what Barack Obama said, and was a conservationist and a negotiator for peace. So Obama was supposedly saddened. you know, this is not the guy that anybody should be saying thank you to or welcoming with open arms. They should be hanging the people behind Bongo and then putting Bongo on the stick afterwards, you know?
Yeah.
But we're talking about, who are we talking about behind Bongo? We're talking about the French Corsican mafia. A couple guys, Michel Tomy and his son Jean-Baptiste, and this guy Robert Feliciaghi, and Jean-Jerome Feliciaghi, and Charles Feliciaghi. Now, Charles, the Feliciaghis, for example, controlled this bank in France that went belly up because of money laundering. And it became a huge scandal because it involved some very powerful people from the United States who also lost a lot of money. And at some point, there was a U.S. congressional investigation which pinpointed the fact that Bongo's money laundering also involves Citibank. But the FIBA bank, when it went up, went belly up, involved these Corsican mafia. And these guys run gaming operations. They run the lottery tickets that are sold in West Africa. And they're involved in winning lucrative construction contracts from Bongo or from Paul Biya or in the Ivory Coast. And they're connected to all kinds of big business that, again, benefits from the Bongo dictatorship and Bongo's family. The guy that's probably going to secede Bongo is his own son, who's the defense, the head of the defense sector in Gabon. And that's another, you know, criminal, basically, because he's been responsible for making sure that Gabon is maintained as a national security state for the United States and for France.
Right. And you were mentioning, you just mentioned, you know, that you know, for lack of a better word, that character, Maurice Templesman. I mean, recently, I believe, like recently, he received some kind of award for his work with the Harvard AIDS Institute. And I know that you've done some research connecting Maurice Templesman, the Harvard AIDS Institute, and biotechnological weaponry and the Pentagon to Africa. What is that? What's the story behind that?
What is that? That's a very good question. You know, all this AIDS, HIV stuff, people should be very suspicious of all the propaganda out there about it. Propaganda can be used in many ways. You know, what I mean by that is the definition of propaganda is information. Everything that I'm putting out is propaganda as well, but it's not black propaganda, which means that I'm trying to tell the truth as best I can. But the black propaganda out there about the AIDS sector is phenomenal. If you look at all the discussion and debate and information and pharmaceutical corporations, it's got all these smoke screens and all this money connected to it. Again, follow the money. So if we follow the money, who is Maurice Templesman, first of all? Well, Maurice Templesman is the Jacques Foucart, which would be France's number one dirty tricks guy in Africa in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and even into the 90s. I think Foucart was still alive in the mid-90s. Maurice Templesman is the equivalent of that, responsible for, directly connected to, the assassinations of Patrice Lumumba and Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana and Congo, Zaire, and both of them revolved around diamonds. Templesman was responsible for making sure that cobalt came out of the big Congo, out of Zaire, under Mobutu. So Templesman, through the CIA and through a guy named Larry Devlin and some other people like Donald Esom, who was there in Nigeria as the ambassador to the United States when President Murtala Muhammad was assassinated back in 1979. Donald Templesman, Maurice Templesman, Donald Esom, Frank Carlucci, another guy, and he's connected to the Carlyle Group and has been, of course, which is connected directly to Bush. These guys were responsible for the covert networks of the United States that operated all over Africa but were based out of, for example, Zaire, out of Mobutu, Zaire. I think that was basically the nerve center, just like Gabon was the nerve center for France and Burkina Faso, formerly Upper Volta, is the nerve center for Israel in Africa. So anyway, this guy, Maurice Templesman, in the 1960s, he was very close to John F. Kennedy. He was very close to Adlai Stevenson, Kennedy's lawyer. And Stevenson, of course, served Templesman as a lawyer as well to secure some of his interests in Africa and through the New York and Washington power structure. Other people connected to Templesman back in the 1960s were some of the big mining magnates in the world. And he became very intimate with Jackie Kennedy Onassis after the death of John F. Kennedy, and of course at some point Templesman and Onassis became lovers, and when Onassis died in 1994, Templesman was at her bedside and he had been her lover for years. Templesman sails off of Martha's Vineyard with the Clintons, as I said, and when Clinton went to Africa in 1998 or 1999, I think it was, he had 100 people on his, he had 99 people on his entourage, so there was 100 people total, and one of them, the guy at his side the whole time, was Maurice Templespan. He was the closest person to Clinton next to Hillary. And the reason that Templespan was there was because Hillary and Bill are involved in diamonds, and they have very shady friends like Robert Friedland and Michael McMurrow, who set up these mining companies, and they're responsible for all kinds of mining atrocities, meaning toxic waste production that's causing people to be sick in places like Arkansas and Canada, as well as in Burma, for example, Indonesia, and Congo and Sudan. And so Templespan set up these networks and maintained the diamond flow out of the Congo and out of Templespan's diamond networks connected to Charles Taylor in Liberia and to Fody Sanko and Sierra Leone and the bloodshed that you'll see portrayed in Hollywood's version in Blood Diamond. And Templespan was connected to the blood diamonds coming out of Angola and still is out of Botswana, South Africa, because he was connected to the De Beers cartel. De Beers, of course, has been the world's biggest diamond cartel in control of the diamonds, and the whole reason why diamonds are considered scarce is because De Beers has controlled the supply so that we have a scarcity situation. So Templespan is De Beers' agent in Africa, and De Beers, of course, is Anglo-American Corporation, big gold and diamond mining and other mining, and the Oppenheimer family, and that is one of the most powerful families in the world coming out of South Africa. So that's where Templespan comes from. His connection to the Harvard AIDS Institute is really interesting. What is a guy like Maurice Templespan? He's also on the board of trustees of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Now, Woods Hole, of course, is, National Geographic will do their stories about how they're helping, understand sharks and we need to respect these sea creatures and all this nonsense. Woods Hole is the NASA of the seas. And NASA and Woods Hole are the Pentagon's arms in outer space as well as in inner space, in deep space, in the sea. And they're involved in undersea mining. They're involved in undersea military operations. They're involved in all kinds of secretive stuff we're never going to hear about. And one of the things they do off the coast of West Africa is mine for diamonds in the seabed. And that's why Maurice Templespan is connected to Woods Hole, because they provide some of the very sophisticated diamond dredging equipment that goes deep down in deep sea and rips up the seabed off of Namibia, Gabon, Angola. So Namibia, another blood-drenched country that we don't know anything about and never hear about. Maurice Templespan's all over it. He supported President Sam Nujoma for years. Templespan supported some of the worst criminals in the world, in the history of the world. And he, of course, being the kingpin behind all of this, is the person that should be brought to account for war crimes and crimes against humanity, especially Mobutu Zaire, for example. So Templespan is on the board of the Harvard AIDS Institute. Now, that's really interesting. What is the Harvard AIDS Institute? Well, the Harvard Public Health Now. You look at their website, and it's the School of Public Health. This is the place where Paul Farmer came from, the guy that wrote the book about structural violence against people in the medical sector. And Harvard, of course, is just this elite university in the United States. It's not connected to the intelligence networks, is it? It is. It's very deeply connected to making the system run and keeping the people malinformed, miseducated, and participating in this nasty system of oppression. Templespan sits on the board of the Harvard AIDS Institute, and Harvard, of course, made some of the legislation which rewrote or cleaned up the diamond trade, and this Kimberley process, it was called, was written by Robert Rotberg, another intelligence operative on the other side of the river in Cambridge. And Rotberg, of course, knows Templespan, and they made sure that Templespan's interests were protected, and the Kimberley process just makes it look like there's a bunch of little Africans over there ripping off the diamonds, and as long as we certify big companies like De Beers and Lazar Kaplan, or Dan Gertler, an Israeli guy who's involved in the Congo, and as long as we certify their companies as clean and safe, then the diamond trade is clean, and you can get your lover a nice, clean, lovely diamond and know that it's not connected to the bloodshed. There's nothing about that story that's true, and this is Maurice Templespan. On the Harvard AIDS Institute, what is his connection? He just won this on February 6th. It was announced that he won this award from the Harvard School of Public Health AIDS Initiative, honoring him for his leadership to individuals who have displayed outstanding vision, leadership, and courage in worldwide struggle against AIDS. This is nonsense. If Maurice Templespan is connected to AIDS, to the AIDS Institute, he's connected to the AIDS system, he's connected to the bio-warfare that's going on through technologies that have been developed, just like we can control the genes these days, like we can, what do you do, when we can clone human beings, we can clone animals, we can clone plants, just like that. They've mapped out the gene, the DNA, in such a way that they can produce, they have produced, First of all, there's a vaccine for malaria, and it was produced through Harvard, and it was produced. There's other vaccines that are also available, but these are only available to the U.S. military and its military partners and to the elites. So you can't get a vaccine for malaria for yourself, and you can't get the vaccines for dengue fever. And so they've also developed these AIDS, these pathogens that are designed to look like medical help, you know, effective pharmaceutical products against disease, when in fact their role is to target only certain individuals who have a certain genetic profile. So what they've done is they've mapped out certain genetic profiles, and those particular profiles are targetable through these pharmaceutical products that they've developed, which is, again, simply biowarfare. That's what Maurice Templespan is involved with. Because Maurice Templespan's role in Africa has been, for the last 60 years, since 1960 at least, I've pinpointed him on the African continent in 1959, but involved with Africa since the FLAC institution was set up in 1954, the Africa Institute, which was set up by Maurice Templespan to produce propaganda, to co-opt individuals, to go into Africa and buy off the brightest and the smartest, and like Omar Bongo, and get them to participate in this nasty system and keep their mouths shut because they're going to make a lot of money and they're going to get a lot of power. So that's what Templespan's role has been. It's depopulation and plunder. So if he's getting an award, it's because he's done something to support the AIDS initiative financially. And he buys his way in the world by collecting large sums of money for congresspeople and giving these large sums of money to congresspeople and senators as a package so that it's able to slip under the radar of campaign finance in a certain way. So Templespan's blood is all over this. It's all over the place, and you don't see him in the media anywhere unless he's receiving some award like this, same as Paul Kagame. He's being celebrated by the system that he has supported in terms of bloodshed and massacring and genocide and absolute brutalization of the people of Africa. And at the very same time, some of us are speaking up against the atrocities that have been committed by these people, by Templespan, by Bongo, by these white agents behind them, especially, you know, companies like Tullow Oil, which is in Gabon and in Uganda on the border with Congo. And the people that run Tullow Oil are also behind the atrocities in both places. So that's the nature of the system, and you know, they celebrate the people that are doing the damage, making them look like heroes with a massive propaganda campaign, while at the same time, information of the kind that I'm producing, for example, it's almost impossible to get it out there.
Yeah,
thanks to you, and thanks to people like you, you know, we're able to get things out, and people pick it up, a small percentage of people will hear it, but most of it, it's just completely whitewashed. It's just completely, you know, it's like dropping a snowball in a snowstorm that covers the Antarctic.
Exactly, yeah. Why do you think? I mean, it's probably kind of an obvious question I'm asking, but why do you think people are so scared to pick that stuff up? And I'm asking an obvious question because maybe to some people that are listening, they don't know how nefarious the corporate media is. But why doesn't the corporate media pick up stories like this that undoubtedly, you know, many of them know about it? So it's not just a case that you know, MSNBC or the New York Times or Fox News doesn't know about what's going on. Why don't they put it into the so-called mainstream channels in America and the world, for that matter?
There's all kinds of stupid reasons. I mean, but it ultimately comes down to white supremacy. What is white supremacy? Racism, you know, you can call it racism. I like to call it white supremacy because I think naming the animal is really important. People don't seem to understand racism, and they're able to say, oh, well, that's just racism, but they don't really understand it. But when it's about their skin color, which is what we're talking about, it's a very different animal. The professor of one of the colleges and universities in Southern California, Francis Njubi, an African-American or an African, he's written a very important paper about how the white system co-ops and uses African-Americans, people of color, to serve its interests and the different kinds of roles that they play, like the comprador class or the intellectuals. So that's an important thing to understand, is that, you know, behind the black people who are doing some of these, creating some of these injustices, often there is a system. And often there are all these white people who are manipulating and controlling the system through money and power and greed and all the normal human things that everybody deals with on a certain basis, you know, every day of their life, and the decisions that we make in terms of morality and in terms of ethics. And most white people aren't going to look at their interests, whether they're white or black, if you're getting a lot of perks and you've got a psychological profile which is based in some sort of trauma or some sort of fear, then you're going to respond from a place of fear. And that means you take care of yourself first, your family second, your close friends third, and then you've spread out and, you know, dole a little bit out here and there in many cases. Now, that's how a lot of people in Africa function, even good people in Congo, good friends of mine. They take care of themselves first, their family next, their closest friends third, and then they'll reach out to the community on a different level. So in the white power system, people deceive themselves into participating. Many people are confronted with the truth, and they come up with some sort of an obtuse example of why they shouldn't, reason why they shouldn't change or why they shouldn't report the truth. Censorship is a very powerful thing, but mind control is a much more powerful thing. And what we're talking about here is mind control. And it doesn't require that you be sat down in some chair by the CIA and given psychedelic drugs or shock treatments or some kind of other mind control that people might jump to that conclusion. What we're talking about is reading the New York Times every day.
Right.
That's mind control. Mind control is listening to the National Public Radio, thinking that this is national, that it's public, and it's radio. It's propaganda. It's funded by the same corporations, and that's why the information isn't out there. Corporations rule the world, and they're ruling and destroying our planet. The same company that was involved in, that is involved in the uranium mining in Gabon, for example, runs an operation in Ohio, which is making people really sick in both Ohio and the state on the other side of the river, and I can't remember at this moment what that is, but the toxic manganese that they're releasing into the environment. People are really sick in this place, and the company is, I can look it up and tell you what it is.
Is it OM?
What's that?
Is it OM or something like that?
No, OM Group is a cobalt group also in Ohio, cobalt company connected to the Congo. This mining group in Ohio is a different name, and I'll think of it in a minute, but I don't have it right now. Aramet Marietta in Ohio. It's in, I think it's in Marietta, Ohio. And by the way, when we were talking about Bongo's access to George Bush, that was all arranged through lobbyists and through PR firms. PR firms and lobbyists have made Bongo look like the good guy. So we're talking about a series of different groups of different lobbyists that have been employed by Bongo in all of his money over the years, including Herman Cohen. And Herman Cohen, of course, is now very close to Barack Obama. He was just given some appointment by Obama. And Cohen is talking about how we need to balkanize and divide Congo up into small states because they can't do it. They can't run their own state, so we need to rip it apart and create a balkanized Congo, which is what he said back in the 1990s when he was in the Bush 1 administration during the Clinton years when he became a lobbyist, and one of his biggest clients for a while was Omar Bongo. Another lobbying firm is Jack Abramoff, who ended up in prison. He was lobbying for a company called a group called Grassroots Initiative, Grassroots Interactive in 2003. Cassidy Associates in D.C. was also getting a lot of money. I don't know how recently, but they as well. And another one, Manat, Phelps, and Phillips. So all of this lobbying was going on. And I brought them up because the trail of thought was, why do people produce this? Why don't people understand? Why isn't it possible to get this information out there? Interests revolve around, you know, people wanting to take their families and see gorillas, the furry kind, in Rwanda. So they don't want to confront the fact that, first of all, they have enough money to do that. And when they get there, they aren't able to see through the whiteness. And the big issue here is obliviousness. And that's the word that I think is the most important. As James Baldwin said at one point in his life, it's the innocence that constitutes the crime. And it's very difficult to articulate this. The innocence, the idea that Mia Farrow is she's doing a hunger strike for Sudan. She's doing a hunger strike to save Darfur. It's the idea that she's innocent. It's the idea that she's not culpable in the slaughter going on in Darfur. It's the idea that she has the privilege and the power to do this hunger strike, and that she has the power in the world as a force from Hollywood to influence people to help save Darfur without ever asking about the role of the Pentagon in Darfur, or without ever asking about the role of the Pentagon in the movies that she made. You know, that's the obliviousness. The obliviousness is that most white people from the United States have eaten so much nonsense about Tarzan, which is where it all began, and then they've eaten all this other stuff that came with it through the National Geographic about wildlife, and then they've eaten all this other stuff about disease and hopelessness, which is just the breeding ground for profits for the pharmaceutical corporations and for the misery industry, which rose up in the 70s and became a profitable corporate business by 2009, which is based in people suffering. And they aren't willing to look at that. They aren't willing to address the fact that what they want to do when they get out of college is go over to Africa because it's an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have these romantic ideas of meeting their lover and getting married to some gorilla in some country like Nicaragua. Or because they think they can go over there and save the furry gorillas because those Africans are so damn stupid and hopeless and tribal that they're going to kill off all the gorillas. Well, I don't care if 5 or 6 or even 10 million Congolese people have been killed. I'm concerned about the last 400 furry gorillas in the world. That's what
right.
they say. And that's white supremacy because it puts people after species, other species, and it says that, first of all, those people are responsible for the killing of those species, which isn't true. And they don't take, and the people that are actually responsible are the people that are flying over there to save the gorillas because they don't ever confront the system that they're part of. And this all filters down into the media and the journalists and all the journalistic institutions and all the privileges and all the profits for a magazine like In These Times, a little alternative leftist rag that is based in profit, meaning that they sell the magazine weekly or biweekly and they pay, you know, $50 or $100 or $200 to their writers, but what they need to do is sell the magazine. If they call everybody in the United States white supremacists, who is, they're not going to sell many magazines. They're not going to sell any magazines if they're Jewish and they're talking about Dan Gertler in the Congo or Lev Levy of Angola, or if they're talking about Maurice Tebbelspan's Jewish-American ties to bloodshed in the Congo.
Right.
That's white supremacy.
Yeah,
on a personal level, as a journalist who wants to sell a story and survive now and then, I practice self-censorship now and then because I know perfectly well that if I eliminate this sentence or if I put it in there in the first place, they're not going to touch my story. And then editor from In These Times, he isn't going to talk to me if I leave that sentence in there. So I cut that sentence, and that's the beginning of the end because it's just another form of prostitution.
Right.
It all comes back to the money, yeah?
Yeah, and you're so right. This country is terrified of those two words, white supremacy. Anything that deflects attention to themselves, that points the attention to themselves as the root cause of systemic issues, social issues that exist not just within these borders of the empire, but outside the borders. That the roots, the basis of these issues. And how they're able to, you know, to live on what the lifeblood is, and that is white supremacy and racism. That's the last effing thing that you'll ever hear them mention because they're scared, they're petrified of that, they're petrified of reality.
Yeah, and you know what makes me, what really pushes my buttons, is the idea that I'm going to make somebody uncomfortable by talking about white supremacy or racism. We wouldn't want to make anybody uncomfortable, would we? I mean, I don't want to make anybody... If I've made anyone uncomfortable out there, I'm sorry. I'll just have to pack up my show and go off to Africa and live with the people who are living with this absolute misery.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the most arrogant part about the whole white supremacy thing is that you're going to make... I'm going to make... Anybody who talks about this, especially if a black person tried to talk about white supremacy in many cases, they'd immediately be shut down and told, you're going to make people uncomfortable. We don't want to do that.
Exactly. It happens
all the time. And my point is, it's the discomfort. Whenever there's a discomfort, that's a psychological issue. You get to the discomfort, you got something hot, whether it's about your individual psyche, your love relationship with your girlfriend, the number of people that you've slept with, what your sexual interests are, et cetera, what kind of food you eat, what kind of addictions you have. You get to something that makes you uncomfortable because everybody's trying to get away from the discomfort. That's the problem with this society. It's about running away from the discomfort. So we've got fat people eating too much of the wrong foods all the time, you know, obesity. And then you've got television shows which come along and make the whole losing your weight thing into a game show, you know. And then it's just disease. It's mental illness, and it's addiction, and it's about looking at the discomfort. And in order to look at the discomfort, all you got to do is stop consuming. And at the top of the list is the media. Stop consuming the media. It's just another thing that people are consuming, you know? But people don't want to look at that discomfort. And it's very uncomfortable for them to look at their discomfort.
Yeah.
So if you got any discomfort out there, brother, take a good look at it. Get out a magnifying glass. Sit with yourself. Meditate and look at your discomfort. And then you can contribute something useful to the world when you can figure out what that discomfort is about. And I say you, I mean me.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I have no problem making people feel uncomfortable. I have no problem making people feel uncomfortable, and I know you don't either. And that's,
you know,
that's,
you know what the rub is, Solomon?
Important.
You know what the rub is? You don't make anybody anything. Neither do I.
Yeah.
If they feel uncomfortable, it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with themselves. I don't make anybody uncomfortable. What they're uncomfortable about is their own psyche and their own state of affairs, their own role in this nasty system, whatever they've lied about or, you know, stolen or who they've hurt in the world. And we're all responsible for these things at some level, even the Dalai Lama, especially the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
So, but that's the point, you know. People don't want to take responsibility for it. But you don't make anybody anything. There's nobody listening to this show that you made anything. You didn't make anybody anything. You didn't make them listen. You didn't make them feel anything. If they feel anything, good for them. If it's anger, good. But you didn't make them feel that. And you didn't make them unhappy. You didn't make them feel uncomfortable. You didn't make them happy. You can't make anybody that. It's their responsibility.
That's a good point. That's an excellent point.
People don't want to take responsibility for their feelings.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. Anything for an addiction to not have to take responsibility. So they'll go out collecting things. They'll get on the enough bandwagon, feeling that they're, you know, a good person. They want to be a good person, et cetera, et cetera. It's just pathology, and there's not a judgment behind that at a certain level. It's, you know, either you have two choices. You either do something about your pathology or you get more sick. And what we have is people getting more and more sick instead of addressing their pathology. It's so darn easy to address it once you start the process.
Yeah.
But,
do you see any possible change within your lifetime, my lifetime, in terms of white supremacy in America? Do you see any change whatsoever? I mean, the older I've gotten, the more jaded I've become, and it's interesting because now it's I almost look like a crazy man when I say that, you know, we're very, very far away from living in a post-racial society. And so many people who continue to consume these large doses of this drug called the mainstream media, you know, they've been sucked into this whole abomination that, you know, because there is a phonetically black, you know, president, the president of African descent, that this means that America no longer is a white supremacist, racist nation. But at the same time, you know, we see police brutality and police murders of unarmed black men still going on. You know what I'm saying? The Sean Bells.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. The Oscar Grants, the Adolph Grimes. I mean, those two just happened within the last few months, you know. And so, you know, does that mean that we're living in a post-racial society? I don't think so. And so I'm kind of bleak about it changing in my lifetime. I can only hope that it gets a little bit better, you know what I'm saying, so that the younger generations continue to push that mantle. But as long as these things are covered up and white supremacy is this word that, you know, if you or I say it, we get shut down, and it's shut down from mainstream channels. When I talk about mainstream channels, I'm talking about school systems, public educational school systems that still push white supremacists agendas. You know what I'm saying? When you have a celebration and a glorification of a Christopher Columbus or a George Washington or a Thomas Jefferson or Andrew Jackson, you're pushing a white supremacist agenda that feeds into subconsciously these young kids, young white kids who have no idea, you know, so subconsciously they're imbibing this white supremacy, you know, without even knowing it. And so they get to be this adult, and when somebody checks them or challenges the whole notion that Columbus was a racist, a murderer, a plunderer, you know, a slave, you know, a slave driver, then, you know, the first thing they do, because of the way they've been conditioned, they get this knee-jerk reaction. What are you talking about? You know, don't say that. Da, 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 you know.
Yeah.
Does it make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Conditioning is the big problem, you know. People need to decolonize their minds, decolonize their bodies. We're just living in a slave system. I mean, it's really right out of the Matrix. You know, you don't have to have the extreme of the idea that there's bodies out there providing, working as Duracells. But we're definitely slaves to a system. And, you know, one of the things that I tell students when they ask basically the same, when they make the same point or ask the same kind of question, and they say that they feel hopeless, and some of the times when I feel hopeless, I remember this as well, and that is hopelessness is again a state of our psychological, it's part of our psychological profile. If we feel hopeless, I contend, and I'm basing this on the experience, the work that I'm doing in a different, completely different sector, and that is in the psychology of breath work. If you've never heard of it, holotropic breath work with Stanislav Grof. Stanislav Grof is the most forward-thinking, transformational individual in the psychology field over the last 50 or 60 years. I mean, very, very significant man. And his work is suppressed, partly because he started out his career doing research about LSD and then shifted after LSD became illegal. He shifted into another altered state of consciousness work, which was breath work, where you just invoke this altered state of consciousness through a form of breathing in a group with different people. So studying this, I find out that I feel, this is what I believe, is that hopelessness is just a state of mind, and that we can all move beyond that, and people do move beyond it in the world. And those people that move beyond it would be people that we could mention the names of. For some reason, this guy, Mahatma Gandhi, you know, he took it further than anybody else was willing to take it, and he became a hero by the virtue of the fact that he refused to participate. He was in the right place at the right time. But the bottom line is there's people like that out there in Congo and in Latin America and in Indonesia and Asia, for example, making these decisions against the state and against the power structure all the time, who we'll never hear about. And they've reached a point in their life where they don't do it out of the – I can name one. His name is Marc Onah Issangi. He's in Gabon, and he's an environmentalist living in a wheelchair. He's got no use of his lower legs. They were never useful to him after he was born. And he's been fighting against the Bongo administration for years and years. And he's been recently, was in January, was arrested along with five other people because they produced a report about corruption within the Bongo administration, and they were refused to allow to be left. They were refused passports to leave the country. Mark just keeps on going. He's not hopeless, you know, and there's a reason for that. People get to this point in their life, they realize that there's something more important to them than their own bodies. And one of my best teachers in the world, Dr. Enoch Page, he's an expert on these subjects we're talking about. He said to me and a group of other people one day, you know, are you going to sacrifice your children to save your body? And if you think about that, it's like, you know, what is our life about? What is life about? What are we here for? If we're living in the construct that says that, the conditioning that says that we have to reach a certain age in our life to have a happy life, to benefit the universe, for example, we have to become 65 or 70, you know, then we will always be operating out of a place of fear. Maybe I'm only supposed to live to be 48 or 49 or 50, or you're only supposed to live to be a couple more years old than you are. Some kids live to be 20. Some very powerful people have died in the early years, and they've been a huge influence on the world, like Patrice right. Lumumba, for example. And maybe that was his course. It was an ugly course, and we'd like to change it, but maybe that was it. For some reason, we know about Lumumba, and we know about his case, and it becomes useful to us to point out that happened. But the bottom line is, I say again, you know, if we feel hopelessness, it's just because of the system that we live under and the construct that we need to preserve our bodies, when it's just a matter of fear. If we get to the root of the fear is preventing me, for example, from taking certain steps in my life that I know will be more profound in terms of being in the world in the way that I want, in terms of being a just human being, in terms of not participating in the system. But I know that those changes will require of me significant changes in my life, and I'm unprepared to make those because of fear, because of what it means, because of my mobility, because of my privileges, because of my access, because I want to love her, you know, whatever reason it is. There's all these fearful things that we do to prevent ourselves from becoming higher beings in the universe,
right?
That higher consciousness. And it's fear and its constructs keeping us from that. And if people can break out of this box, there's no telling what people out there listening are capable of. We're just waiting to see, brother, what happens to them when they break out of this box and take over their own destiny and stand up against this nasty system in profound ways that we can't even imagine. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen? And I would say, you know, when I feel hopeless, I go back to the breath work, because the breath work brings me out of a state of hopelessness and into a state of greater personal power. And because I was not born into a family where I was given personal power, it was taken from me for many years in my life. And the educational system did that as well. And so it's been a struggle for me to get to the place where, you know, where I can think and talk the way I do, but I still deal with all these demons inside myself, in my psychology. And, you know, so I would go back to that issue of the sense of being able to achieve the impossible as an individual, but also getting to that place, but also getting to the place of realizing that as a group, we can make huge differences, and people don't think that they can.
Right.
I said a lot. I apologize.
Yeah, but no, Keith, that's like the perfect place to end our show. We have a few minutes left, and I just wanted to say that the point you just made was absolutely perfect to end the show, because it's a call out to listeners, who's ever listening, and it's not making the assumption, because there could be people listening that are doing amazing things right now, and that's good. And we should always continue to push the precipice in terms of trying to do more and more. And any war is not just fought. Most wars are not just fought on the ground or in the air or by sea. They're fought on different fronts. And so one of the fronts in terms of us trying to destroy this nefarious system that perpetrates war and destruction and plunder, white supremacy, racism, and all these different things. One of the fronts in terms of fighting, you know, this system is against the system of misinformation that is proliferated by this huge multi-billion dollar industry called mainstream media. And so, people that are listening, if what Keith has said during this interview, has struck a chord with you, and if you have a soul, I'm sure it has. Take this interview, send the link to your friends, send it out to all of your networks, your friends, your families, and just ask them to listen. Guaranteed, most people listening to the show that you send it to, it'll be the very first time that they've heard this kind of information and heard this kind of information within this context. The second thing I asked you to do was to visit Keith's website, which is allthingspass.com. That's allthingspass.com. Visit his website. There's numerous ways that you can help him continue to do the work he's doing, as well as supporting, first and foremost, supporting the people that he's trying to support with the journalism that he's doing. So, Keith, I want to give you the last word. What if you can just kind of reiterate how people can get in contact with your work, and what are some of the ways that they can help you as well as other comrades? I remember last time you were on here, you graciously mentioned the work that Friends of the Congo are doing, and that's friendsofthecongo.org, and you mentioned the work that Maurice Carney and Kambali and Paul Pumphrey and those folks are doing. What are some of the things folks can do that are listening to the show for the first time and the second time, and also how can they get in contact with you if they want to try to bring you in to speak at their organization to kind of shed the light on certain things and raise the specter of consciousness even higher?
Thank you, Solomon. I do give multimedia presentations using images photography that I've taken around the world, which shows the stuff that the New York Times won't show you, for example, but it also shows the beauty and the struggle and the compassion and the graciousness of people in Africa, for example, or Afghanistan. And one of the things that's really important for people to remember is that there are people out there on the front lines all over the world, and not on the front lines, in the back pockets and the corners and the support systems, that are doing phenomenal things that we'll never hear about because the system excludes that information and it divides us and conquers us instead of connecting us together and giving us the sense that there is this incredible possibility. And it's really important to recognize that people in Congo, for example, the big Congo and other places, are blockading the logging. And in Malaysia, the Penan people fighting against the logging, and the Canadian First Nations people fighting against the mining. And the question I would have is, are we going to turn our backs on these people and say that it's hopeless because we're unwilling to take the steps that we need to do to help people in places where, with so little to work with, it's not hopeless for them because they realize that life is life and you have this opportunity. And even if and for them, it's also in many cases not about this life. It's about the spiritual system that they live under. And so I would ask, what is your spiritual basis? You, me, one, what are our spiritual beliefs and where do they come from? And why do we believe that we can't make a difference? And why do we believe in this or that God or goddess or this or that lifetime, and just ask questions about this. And that's the kind of stuff that I end up talking about when I give these presentations. If people wanted to book me for a presentation, it's pretty easy. Go to allthingspass.com and send me an email. You can also read my work there, and you can read it in other places on the web, but just by typing in my name, Keith Harmon Snow, it's all over the place. You can also support other organizations like Friends of the Congo and the Campaign to End Genocide in Uganda Now, CEGUN, and also Brain Forest, which is Mark Osana, Mark Esangi, Mark Ona Esangi in Gabon. This guy runs a small NGO called Brain Forest. And there's another one on the web in Namibia who's doing, this guy in Namibia is doing phenomenal work, but because he's in Namibia and because nobody knows anything about Namibia, nobody knows anything about him, and his name is Phil Ya Nangolo, and his organization is the Search on Namibia, NSHR, Namibia Society for Human Rights, I think, or National Society for Human Rights Namibia. And Phil needs some support. He needs to get his story out there, and there's nobody helping him do that. So these are important things to take into account and make a difference, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much.
No, it's my pleasure. And as I said before, Keith, the door is always open to Your World News. And so anytime that there's hard-hitting news that or research that you've unearthed, you always have an open platform on this show to get the word out, because it serves the greater good. And you know, we're not supported by any corporation, so getting the word out, you know, that's why I plead to folks that are listening to this show, spread the word to all your friends and family just by sending a quick email, a link to this program to everyone that you know, because we're not going to be featured on Oprah's show or on MSNBC or anything else.
No,
so
it's not going to happen. So if you're holding your breath for that, brother, you should let go.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And by the way,
yeah.
You know, those organizations that I mentioned, they need financial support. If you have the means, Jesus, what are you saving it for? And also me, I live under the poverty line, and it'd be great if people want to help out with $10, $20, or enough to help me make a real difference by, you know, when I go to Africa, Congo, I always take along drugs and medicines, malaria drugs and Band-Aids that people in the most rural places don't have. A little bit of Neosporin and a Band-Aid can save a life in an equatorial country. So, you know, I'd love to have some support so I could, you know, be more effective. So.
And if they want to support you, is there somewhere on your website that they can leave
it
and donation?
There's a PayPal link, and people can also contact me if they want to send something in the mail. And again, support those other organizations. Support Project Stop Excision. It's stopexcision.net. That's a fantastic project in Mali, and it's working with Malian women to stop female genital mutilation, which again is another crime against humanity. And it's not a cultural imperialist thing to be stopping this. It was never an African phenomenon to begin with. It was brought in by the Arabs to control women. And you can learn about it on stopexcision.net. It's a really great site run by important, wonderful, lovely, simple people with very little to work with. So, yeah.
All right.
There
Thank you.
You.
For Your World News, for Keith Harmon Snow, for the Your World News staff and family, I'm Solomon. Until next time, peace and blessings.
Thank you so much, brother. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
This song probably been done about a million times, but it ain't never been done like mine. We're talking about a million Africans. We're talking about 10 million Africans. We're talking about 100 million Africans. We're talking about the genocide that went down in Rwanda. We're talking about Darfur. We're talking about Sierra Leone. We're talking about a million diamonds. We're talking about the Congo, B. We're talking about a million of our people in prison. We're talking about a million of our people dead, unemployed, homeless, hungry, B. 1 million Africans. 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
They say we ain't got no right to complain. I just laugh at them. You can have the whips and the chains. I don't hate on them, but hopefully they gonna catch up. I ain't gonna wait on them. Kanye, Lupe, Pharrell, I will skate on them. 1 million black men locked up in prison.
Hold
and
it down.
Think I'm kidding what it is, but I isn't. And if you didn't know, it's just cause you ignorant. Cause pigs lock up motherfuckers just cause of their pigment. That is racial profiling. No, I'm not wildin'. Y'all shuckin' diving.
Yeah, it's about
grinning and smiling. 1 million people was here before they even came. And ever since they came, they just changed the game. They brought a few million more and then they changed our names. That Turner Devil Burner come to burn your sister flame.
We gon' burn it
1
down,
million
baby.
Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans.
1 million Taino, 1 million Arawak, 10 million more of our people who ain't coming back. 10 million of our people with scars on their back.
Cracker, tell me that it don't matter. But matter of fact, I'm the surprise in the box. I will crack a jack. After that, ain't nothing else to do but to holler black.
1 million kids who ain't got no options. Either they down with the goons or the goblins. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Drop them off here and now you is a Haitian. Drop you off here and now you is Jamaican. 1 million, 10 million, let's bring it back, man. Yes, they are the devil. What's the devil to a blood man? Nathan, nothing. They ain't saying nothing. We don't need another old white man. Finger on the button, cause the last white man had that type of power. Had 6 million people taking gasoline showers. The Bible told me this world is ours. The meek shall inherit, but that don't mean to be cowards. One stupid white man can knock down 2 towers. Y'all niggas got it backwards. Y'all niggas got it backwards. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Wampanoag, 1 million Blackfeet, 1 million Navajo, 1 million Apache, 1 million Iroquois, 1 million Sioux. You done killed about 1 billion people, maybe even 2. We take a nation of millions, hold us back, I thought you knew. And everywhere they go, this is just how they do. Was 11 million Africans living around Soweto. 1 million white folks had them in the ghetto. The ghetto, the ghetto. You all love the ghetto. You talk about it so much, but we ain't seen no bread though. Break them all. I take 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4. Build a couple hundred schools, hit you for 4 million more. 1 million Haitians, refugees, know the score. Cause you don't want 1 million motherfuckers at your door, man. I am Farrakhan and 1 million man marching. Approach me with caution, 1 million people watching. I do this so often, 1 million places on this earth, but I come from Boston. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. 1 million Africans, 2 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans. Harry and Dudley came too. We got a long legacy, this is how we do it. Uno the prophet, now turn the devil burner. 1 million Africans, 10 million Africans, 100 million Africans passed through that transatlantic slave trade, the African Holocaust.